Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored. My chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I travel to sit face-to-face with my guests in their own homes to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. When John Gierak mentioned Bill Fitzsimmons and Trout Bum, he wrote about Bill's professionalism, skill, and deliberate efforts to avoid the camera. So, naturally, I was delighted when Bill agreed to share more of his story here on Anchored. From Christmas Island in the early 1980s, the early days of fly fishing for tarpon, and owning a fly shop in Basalt, Colorado, Bill knows the fishing industry as much as anyone. Bill and his brother Mark are regulars around my campfire in BC, and this fall I was finally able to record him. In this episode, we discuss the early days of saltwater destinations, fly size, and if catch and release fishing is selfish. Bill Fitzsimmons, international man of mystery. That's really what you are to me.
I think you're being a little kind, and I appreciate the compliment, but I'm not sure that that's the case.
Well, let me go ahead, and I've got to set the stage for people listening. For starters, yes, the audio quality is going to be a little bit poor in this episode because we are sitting in my cabin on the Bulkley with a sleeping baby and no power on, and we're using the old USB mic. So I will do what I can in post-pro to try to clean up the audio, but it's kind of just organic, back to basics here. So that's the first stage.
That's the world I grew up in, and that's the world I continue to live in. So.
Perfect. It's fitting. I did it just for you to make you comfortable. The second stage I want to set for people listening is I met Bill accidentally and very embarrassingly. I don't want to paint myself in too negative of a picture here, so I'm going to just kind of keep it broad, okay?
Okay.
I met Bill while I was having a temper tantrum on the river. Somebody had done something. Somebody shit in my boat launch, okay? Like right in the middle of the boat launch, and just threw toilet paper everywhere and plastic wrapper everywhere. And there were these two lovely men that were floating down. And that's right. I said, have you seen an Australian man up above? And you guys said, yeah, he's coming in. And you guys were so nice. And I was going to fish. It was at the run in front of my house here. And I said, well, I'm too angry to fish. You guys fish. And I had no idea that you and your brother Mark were Fitzsimmons brothers. So I felt really stupid. But then also very thankful because you've stayed in our lives ever since. And so hopefully you don't.
How many years ago was that? That's been 5 years ago now.
Or wait, no, hang on. So 4 years ago. Yeah.
Four or five.
No, because I got game cams right after.
That's right.
Five years ago and 4 years ago, I rigged this place with cameras. Yep. So that's how we met.
It was just a tent here then.
That's right. Yeah, before it was taken down in the ice storm. So, Bill, let's just start where we start, everybody. So where were you born and raised?
Montpelier, Vermont, in the capital city of Vermont, city of all of 8,000. I lived there until I left to go to college.
Are you offended if I ask how old you are?
No, I'm not, but I won't answer.
Okay.
No, I was born in 48.
Okay.
So I'm 71 years old now.
Okay. Now, what about Mark? Is he younger than you?
Mark is younger. Yeah, Mark's 4 years younger than I. I am the oldest of four.
So if you had to describe yourself as a kid, how would you describe yourself?
Well, I always liked to fish. Probably my first memory, if I think back, the first thing that really is a strong memory for me, I can remember at 5 years old going down to New Hampshire to spend a week with my grandfather, with my dad's father. And he didn't know what to do with me.
Your dad or your grandpa?
My grandpa. You know, he's had been widowed, had no other grand... I mean, I was the oldest grandchild, so we had no experience with it. And so I went down there, and he was kind of at a loss as to what to do to keep me amused. But I always liked catching bugs. I had a butterfly collection already, and a friend of his there volunteered to take me fishing. It was in some small little New England brook trout stream. And this guy, I think, did it as a favor and would have really rather go by himself, but took the five-year-old kid along anyway. And he set me on a rock out there with a little spin cast kind of outfit. I don't even remember what it was. And put a worm on and had me toss this thing into a little pool there, and I started catching dace in creek chubs. And he went fishing and came back with these magnificent brook trout.
Oh.
Which, I mean, look at the colors of those things. I'd never seen one before in my life. And he said, okay, well, he's going to fish up a little farther. Let's move. And he took me up to a different rock. I sat on it and started catching these little things. And I caught a brook trout, and it was massive. And I showed it to him. I called him over, and I come over, look at this, look at this. Oh, boy, I got to take this back and show it to Grandpa. I mean, look how big that thing is. And he said, no, we can't do that. It's not big enough. And so this massive fish that I thought was, the most stupendous thing I'd ever seen proved to be less than 6 inches long.
Oh, okay.
Because that was the limit.
Right.
Okay, it had to be over six if you were going to keep it. At that time, I didn't know it in retrospect after learning what had gone on and becoming aware of the various regulations. I realized that this massive fish, which is the largest thing I'd ever seen in my life, was probably somewhere in a 4 to 4.5 inch range. But I do remember that fish. I started catching them then, and from then on, that's all I wanted to do was go fishing. And luckily, my dad started taking me, and it's kind of gone on from there.
So this is interesting. When you think back to that time as a kid, in your head, how big is the fish in your memory?
Well, I remember at the time, I couldn't believe that he was going to tell me that thing was too small. I mean, because look at the size of it.
Do you remember it being like 5 pounds or anything?
I don't think I had any perspective.
Okay.
But it was so much bigger than those 2-inch dace and chubs that I was catching. And the colors of it. There's no way a thing could be that colorful and not be big.
Yeah, right.
Especially to a five-year-old.
Right. So your dad didn't fish before then?
My dad fished, but we did not have the opportunity. At that time, he was pretty busy trying to get a house built and trying to make a living. And, you know, he was a veteran just back from the war. So it was really a couple years after that my dad started fishing. We'd spend a couple weeks each summer on a lake in Vermont. And although there were no trout, we fished for smallmouth bass. And I have very fond memories of going out in the evenings, paddling around in a canoe, throwing a jitterbug, a black jitterbug, up against these cement walls, the retaining walls that held in supported the road around the lake. And so the water was 2 feet, 3 feet deep right off the cement walls, and it was all the riprap that they had fallen off when they were building the road, and it was filled with crawdads. And bass would come into the shallow water in the evening, and we caught them, you know, every night. And it was all very visual kind of thing. You'd throw out that big old jitterbug, and it'd come walking across the top, and these things would come up and smash it. I remember catching one. My dad had a friend who worked for the same insurance company that he worked for, who had a cabin down on the lake, and he was sort of the dean of bass fishermen of Lake Maury. And I caught this fish, and I can remember my telling my dad, "Dad, grab it, grab it, grab it!" And we're in a canoe, and it's tippy, and he's looking down at this fish and thrashing around, and the fish's mouth is full of hooks, and it's about dark, and there wasn't any way that he was going to stick his hand down into that fish's mouth. We didn't have a net, and you just grab bass by the lip. But he was very reluctant to stick his hand into that fish's mouth with all those treble hooks until the fish was pretty well expended. And so we got him, and it was, according to Mr. Wellman, the authority, it was the largest smallmouth that had been taken in the lake in 10 or 12 years or something like that.
So that wasn't just your young mind thinking about it?
Oh, no, it was a big fish. In fact, in my house now, I still have, when we got home, Dad took an old grocery bag, one of those brown bags that, you know, you don't get in the grocery store anymore, and he cut it open with scissors and laid the fish down on the grocery bag and traced the outside of the fish on that bag. And I still have that. I had it framed. Aww. And I've got it up on the wall in the house. And I think the fish was, you know, for a Vermont smallmouth, it was big. I believ that it was 4.5 pounds. It was over 20 inches long, and a big old fat bellied bass, you know, like they get. But I still have that in my dad's handwriting. He was left-handed, and you can tell he was left-handed. Caught by Billy Fitz, was the 1st of July, and I think it was 1959 or something like that.
What about fly fishing?
That was something I didn't get into until after I had moved out west. I fished the brook trout streams just with spinning gear and worms, and fished every single day all summer from when I was maybe 13 or 14 until I went away to college.
So you fished throughout your high school years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Every day all summer. Had a couple friends, and we always went. And I'd bring home brook trout for dinner and pretty much lived on those. When I went out west after graduating from college in Vermont.
Where is west for you?
Out to Colorado.
Okay.
I went out there for the skiing. I did a lot of ski racing when I was growing up. I moved out there for the skiing to see a gal that I spent most of my college years with. And I got a job doing marketing work for the Aspen Skiing Corporation. And one of the guys that I worked with, we worked for the Skiing Corporation during the day and stamped cans at the local grocery store at night from 4 o'clock until midnight. He was an aquatic biologist from the University of Montana, went to school in Missoula. And Frankie tied flies and fly fished. Just hanging around with him, I decided I needed to start fly fishing. I had somehow found an old used rod and a mismatched reel and mismatched line at the thrift store in Aspen and started fishing with that. My folks heard about this, and the first Christmas that I was in Aspen, which would have been in 1970 or 71, they bought me a fly tying kit for Christmas, a little knowing what kind of beast they were going to unleash as a result of that gift. And I started tying flies. Boy, I tied a lot of them, mostly out of scrounged materials. Couldn't afford anything else. We had Frankie and I both lived in the same apartment complex, and they had the really nasty old shag carpeting. You could reach down with your hand and pull this stuff out of the carpeting. It was kind of a brownish gold kind of color. And we tied a fly with hare's ear material for the back half of the body and this dubbing material from the carpet with a brown hackle, cheap old brown hackle, palmed through, and we called it a rug rat. And we caught, you catch fish all day long out of the Roaring Fork in a frying pan with that little nymph in a size 14 or a size 12.
What did you take in college?
Boy, as little as possible. Mostly I chased a gal around in college, and we skied a lot. A girl I met at some ski races. We were together for 45 years. But I would not call myself a very serious student. I majored in English, minored in German, took a lot of journalism courses, and barely escaped with a degree, but did escape with a great girlfriend. So that was that made life worthwhile for me.
What did you want to do, though?
I wanted to go skiing.
No, I understand. Okay, with your career, what was your career plan?
I did not have a career plan. I wanted to make a living by going skiing. I wanted to be a ski racer or do something. I didn't know exactly.
Did you make a living doing that?
Yeah, I did. I ran a marketing department for the Aspen Skiing Corporation for a number of years. I was in charge of all of their racing events, the World Cup races, the pro races. Ran all those events at Aspen, Buttermilk, Snowmass, Breckenridge, and also we were 50-50 partners with the Canadian government in developing Blackcomb.
Cool.
And I ran the events at Blackcomb when they were opening up there, too.
So how long did you work in that industry for?
Oh, gosh. During the winter, I think I did that for 7 years or so, 6 or 7 years during the winter. I spent one summer working for them building lifts and realized that that was something I didn't want to do again. So during the summer after that, I decided I needed to do something else. So I started a one-man fly tying and guiding operation.
Okay, so leading up to that point then, had you become friends with people in the fly fishing industry?
No, I didn't know anybody. This was on a little stream in Colorado that was semi-well known. You know, back in those days, before the internet, so everything was word of mouth or the printed word. The river that I was on, I lived along this river, it was called the Frying Pan River, was probably known best because Ernie Schwiebert wrote about it. Ernie was a big fan of the river, and, you know, I got to know him when he came to fish. You know, it was a tail race fishery. It was a phenomenal trout fishery before the dam was built. And they buried a tremendous amount of water when they built the dam. The portion of the Frying Pan that is now beneath Rude Eye Reservoir was a meandering oxbow, classic dry fly stream. There was a place on the Frying Pan below the dam, or above the dam now, or underneath the dam now, I should say, where you could park your car by the road or by the river and walk down the bank and get in the river and fish about a mile or a mile and a quarter of a river upstream, winding back and forth through these bends until it came back to the road again, and then walk 100 yards back to your car. So that's what it did through that high alpine valley, just big horseshoes and back and forth. And they buried it underneath the icy cold waters of Rude Eye Reservoir. And now there's only 14 miles of it between the dam and its confluence with the Roaring Fork River in Basalt, Colorado, which is where my fly shop was.
Is that what the one-man fly operation was?
Well, it started out, I knew I wanted to do something with the fishing thing as it became obvious that I wasn't going to be a professional skier forever. And my girlfriend from college, we were still together, of course, and we purchased an old run-down group of cabins on the Frying Pan. There were six old log cabins and a main house that had been utilized as long-term rentals by absentee owners for a number of years. And it was a partnership that owned it due to the fact that there were four of them or five of them. And it was such a small deal, it was not worthwhile for any one of them to take charge of it. And it was a mess. There was no living anything on the property. They parked everywhere. People changed their oil in the middle of the the lawn. The cabins were run down. The roofs leaked. And they realized that either they were going to have to put a bunch of money into it or sell it. And they tried to sell it, and nobody would buy it because it was such a mess. And I knew one of the guys that was one of the owners. And I approached him and said, what's it going to take? What if I decide to buy this, they're going to try to buy this, what kind of deal can you give me?
Were you going to make it a lodge? What was your plan?
I didn't have a plan.
Okay.
That was before the pre-plan, or in the pre-planning days. I needed to get something, buy something. I had no money. We had no money at all. And so they agreed to sell me the cabins, and they would finance the whole thing. And in lieu of a down payment, all I had to do was assume the liability for the damage deposits of the existing renters. It was like $600 or something. I didn't have the $600, but I assumed the liability for their damage deposit, and that was my down payment. And so we moved into the main house, and I started fixing it up and started fixing up the cabins, and tore all the roofs off, put on new shake roofs, fixed up all the logs, built rock planters. Actually, my other brother moved out one summer and helped me do some of that stuff. And we fixed up the cabins. I put down, I can't remember how many thousand square feet of sod, reclaimed the driveway, turned it into a lawn, and planted flowers everywhere and made it look like a kind of a neat little, you know, resortish log cabins up in the mountains. And there was a creek that ran right through the property, separated the main house from the cabins, and it was called Taylor Creek.
But I've heard of Taylor Creek.
Taylor Creek was the name of my fly shop. And so I started renting the cabins out to fishermen. And on the other side of the creek from where the cabins were was the main house, and there was a garage. And the garage was built for a Volkswagen Beetle. But the garage was so small that you had to let the passenger out before you pulled the car into the garage because it wasn't wide enough to open both doors.
Yeah.
So it was not a very big structure at all. And I turned that into my fly shop. I put a fly tying bench in there and had a box that we made that had the flies in it. And I put a sign down, Taylor Creek Cabins, fly shop open. And I tied all the flies. I guided out of there. I got $55 a day for a full day guide trip for three people.
Whoa!
Or two people.
Were you rafting? Were you on foot?
It was all wade trips. All wade trips on the frying pan. And at that time, I could fish all 14 miles of water on the frying pan. None of it was posted. None of it was catch and release. It was all under an 8-fish bag limit. There were no special regulations anywhere in Colorado at that time. So I started doing that. If I was guiding and Jerry was home, people would come in and buy flies, and I had a green. Actually, it's funny. It was my dad's old tackle box that we used to use on Lake Maury. I had this green tackle box, and I had change in the little compartments on top, and the dollar bills were in the big compartment in the bottom. And if people would come in and buy flies, and they'd figure out how much they owed, and they'd put their money in the tackle box.
You operated on an honor system?
Yeah. Well, if Jerry was there, she'd go in and people would do that. Yeah. You know, yeah, do it that way. If she was not there and I was not there, then we were closed.
Okay.
But, you know, we had young kids at that time, so she was home most of the time. She was a stay-at-home mom and helped take care of the garden. We grew most of our own food, shot a couple deer, a couple elk every year.
How many kids did you have?
Four.
I have to ask a personal question. Without having a plan and kind of winging your career and having four children, were you ever terrified that you wouldn't be able to support a family? I mean, a lot of people nowadays battle with this. How did you handle it?
Well, we supplied most of our own food. It cost us very little to live. I had the rental income from the cabins in terms of making my mortgage payments. I would spend about a month each fall getting firewood. I tore out the heating system in the house because we needed the furnace room. We turned into a bedroom when we started having more kids than we should have. And we got a soapstone stove from Vermont, a Hearthstone wood-burning stove, and we could heat the whole house with wood.
Yeah.
So it didn't cost us anything for utilities or very little for utilities. I irrigated out of the creek. Watered all the lawn out of the creek. So it really cost us very little to live. I had the shop going, and at that time, I was still working for the Skiing Corporation during the winter, doing the marketing work.
How did you market your own company?
Boy, it was word of mouth back in those days and just getting to know people. I met some folks, Charlie Myers, who became a very dear friend. Charlie was the outdoor editor of the Denver Post, and Charlie kind of took me under his wing. I would have been in my late 20s, maybe early 30s when we met, and Charlie and I used to fish together. And I started telling you earlier, I went up to, had the little fly shop going, and I went up to the FFF conclave in West Yellowstone, Montana. And at that time, I tied every spare second I had. I love tying flies. And I tied a crawdad pattern that was incredibly realistic. It was all natural materials, you know, with claws and legs and pinchers. And it did look like a crawdad.
But what for? To catch what?
I never fished with it.
Okay.
I just tied it.
Sure.
Some people fish for bass with it, but we didn't have bass there, so I've never even cast it. But at any rate, it was a neat looking fly, and I had fun tying them. And Charlie saw one of them, and he put it on the lapel of his sport coat up at the FFF conclave in West Yellowstone, and just kind of as a something to talk about, whatever. People kept saying, "Well, who tied? Well, look at that thing." And you know, back in those days, it was the industry was different. There weren't all the different tires, you know, splashing stuff all over the internet and all over the magazines, it was a much simpler, frankly, cleaner and more pleasant industry to be a part of. And Charlie ended up coming to me and saying, "Well, you know, people want to watch you tie those things." And it's a close-knit group. There might have been maybe two or three, maybe 400 people total that would go to these conclaves. A lot of them shop owners, people from the industry, the rod manufacturers, what few of them there were. And then just serious fly fishermen types would be there. And they would go to West Yellowstone. It is the Mecca and one of the areas that had some of the finest trout fishing anywhere in the country. And people would go there to fish, to be there at the same time as this conclave, just to get together with people that spoke the same language as them and look at some of the new stuff, you know, as they do now, too. You go to those shows, April. And so Charlie wrangled me an invitation to tie at this thing. And I thought that was pretty good. So he said, "Well, show up tomorrow morning and we'll have a place for you to tie." So I went in the next morning, and sure enough, there was a place at the fly tying table with an empty chair, and he had a little name tag thing on it that said my name, and I was supposed to sit there, and I looked over to one side of me, and there was a name tag that said George Harvey, and George was, you know, Professor Emeritus of Fly Fishing at Penn State University. George was probably in his mid-60s, I would guess, then. Just a wonderful, respected man, knew more about the literature, the sport, the history, than probably anybody. And then on the other side was this guy named Lee Wolf. And I thought, holy crap. So we sat down to tie. It probably took me 20 minutes to get my hands shaking in the same direction. I was breaking thread. I was dropping my scissors. I stabbed myself with my scissors. But after the bleeding stopped, these guys were great. I sat there and tied flies, and that was sort of my introduction to the industry. And very gracious people, welcoming. It's a different world
How do you view it now, Bill? Sorry to cut you off, but how do you view it now?
I'm glad I did it then. I always consider myself sort of a dinosaur and am. There are obviously some wonderful people that are still a part of this industry, but there is something about the glory shots, the YouTube, the unending promotion that occurs on the internet.
Because you're not even on social media, are you?
No.
So you don't even, there's a whole area that you haven't even seen yet.
Well, I've seen enough of it to know that I don't want to see any more of it.
I believe it.
And that is not meant to be demeaning. It just is. I just don't have an interest in it. I've seen so many things go downhill. The main reason I sold that business, was that I finally got to the point that I couldn't be cordial to the people that I had to be nice to in order to be successful in the business. We had so many folks, I don't say so many, it's not like hundreds, but
enough,
that had never fly fished before, that came to us and discovered something that is a wonderful sport, decided they really want to do this. They fish with the guides. We teach them how to catch these fish, how to cast, how to appreciate the sport. They traveled with us. And then they go up the river and they buy a ranch and they put up a posted signs. And now nobody can fish there except for their friends. And these were the waters that I used to guide on, the waters that I taught my kids to fish on. And I can't fish them anymore. Now the frying pan of the 14 miles that I used to fish, approximately half of it is posted. They've gone in with heavy excavation equipment and manufactured these runs and put in, they call it stream rehabilitation. We call it stream rearrangement. They're very not natural looking. I mean, they're that structure that supports fish and all, but it doesn't look like a trout stream that that nature created. It's a man-made trout stream. They'll put in a bunch of great big fish that they bought. And then have some friend of theirs who's never fished before be able to come up and catch a 7-pound fish or something, deformed. it's a different world than the one that I found when I first fished there.
Is that why you started branching off into the more natural fisheries like BC and like Christmas Island?
I started doing that. Our guide business was primarily was for trout fishing and in Colorado. I had one of the gals that worked for me for the skiing corporation. Her boyfriend was from Miami, and he had a friend in the Keys who ran the headboat at Bud and Mary's in Isla Mirada. You know, the big charter boat that takes 100 people out there bottom fishing and stuff like that. Jackie lived in Isla Mirada, and they went down in the spring after the ski lifts closed to spend a couple weeks down there just to get away from the snow and the mud and the spring drearies. And once the ski lifts closed, and they invited us, Jerry and I, to go down and spend some time with them down there.
Approximately what year?
That probably was in the early 80s. I'm going to say maybe 81. So we spent about 10 days down in the Keys, and there was a young guide in his first or second year of guiding out of Bud and Mary's who rented the house across the street from where we were staying, and I got to know him. He didn't really have any customers that could cast a fly rod well, and that was something that was always pretty easy for me to do. And we got to know each other, and I went out and fished with him just for fun after his charters. We hit it off and started fishing together. I would go down and fish in a fly bonefish tournament in the fall with him, and he'd come up and go elk and deer hunting with me in Colorado. We just kind of worked out a trade that way. And I always felt that, you know, that the Keys guides were, oh, probably the most qualified, the most necessary of any of the guides that I'd ever, you know, come in contact with. You can't do it without them, you know. There's an awful lot of islands out there, and they all look exactly the same, especially in the dark. So I kind of put them on a plateau above all others. And, you know, I decided this saltwater fly fishing is a pretty good time. I like this. So I started looking at ways to grow the fly shop business, one of which obviously was to get into the travel thing.
Mm-hmm. Was that big back then with other companies?
Frontiers was pretty much it. I read a thing about Christmas Island. Word was just getting out that there was something there. It was pretty rough, believe me.
Yeah, because when was the first year that you went there?
It was before the mid-80s.
Yeah, that's so early.
Yeah, it was. You never knew exactly when the plane was going to come. It was one flight a week, chartered from Air Nauru to get down there. I think that they had, if I remember correctly, they offered two packages, one for 5 days and one for 10 days. But many of the 5-day packages ended up being 10-day packages because the plane didn't come.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Did you ever get stuck?
Not really stuck. We did one time. The plane didn't come, and they had to wake us up at about 3 o'clock in the morning and say, "Now the plane's coming. You know, if you want to be on it, get your stuff together." The hotel was really rough. It was an old British Army barracks, the Captain Cook Hotel. We had a big old land crab that lived in our shower. You'd go in and turn on the hot water. He'd come out of the... There was no grate over the shower drain.
Right.
He'd come up out of the drain as soon as the hot water went down there and climb up in a corner on the wall until you turned the shower off, and he'd go back down and drain.
Hey, what did they do for drinking water back then? That was really before bottles.
You brought it in. Okay. They had cisterns, but no, any water that we drank, it came in on the same plane that we came in on. And the first time that we went there, I mean, pretty much nobody had ever been there. And I thought, well, here, this is a pretty big deal. The fishing was phenomenal.
Really? What, like, were the was it GTs?
There was everything. The bonefish were unpressured and very, very agreeable.
Were they big?
They'd not seen a fly. Well, you know, Pacific bonefish tend not to be as big as the Florida fish. Mm-hmm. They're a different stature. I think that they spend more time running around trying not to get eaten. So they're not those great big fat slobs like you get on the grass flats in Isla Mirada. There were some good fish. You know, we had fish that were 9 pounds, or I don't know if I ever saw a 10 pounder there, but I saw, you know, 9 pound fish with some regularity on certain flats. But the neat part of it was the variety of flats. There were soft flats that the fish would come up and tail on. There were a lot of coral flats where they'd be just darting around eating, I think, primarily bay fish that lived among the coral. And you could fish the oceanside flats where you've got waves coming in, and there's a barrier reef, and between there and the beach, There were fish, and those fish were incredibly strong and fast. And you could go out and catch 40 or 50 of them in a day if you wanted to, easily.
Were the triggers just stupid?
You know, we didn't really fish for them.
That just wasn't a thing back then?
No, people were fishing for bonefish and trevally, some for milkfish.
Tuna?
Some offshore fishing, a little bit. Mostly it was for bonefish, and that was what people wanted to catch there. And we did a lot of trips there. It was a great destination to sell to anglers, because regardless of your level of expertise or fly rod skills or ability to see fish or experience level. Everybody exceeded their expectations there. Guys that were pretty good came home thinking they were really good. And guys that didn't think that they didn't, thought that they didn't have a chance, would come back thinking, I may have to do this again, you know. And we ended up taking two or three groups a year there. I don't know. I counted it up once on my passports. I don't know if it was, 35 trips or 37 trips or something like that over the years. So it was that was a big part of it. And we did other travel things too. We had some lodges in Alaska that we booked for, and did trips to Belize and Mexico and the Bahamas. And I did a promotional trip to Christmas Island. The Fitzgeralds wanted to inject some new life into the Christmas Island fly fishing program and produce a new brochure and try to get the word out to the rest of the people in the industry, other shop owners and stuff, that it was available. They asked me to talk to some of the powers that be, the government people, on Christmas and see what type of promotional program we could put together to get a group of people in the fly fishing industry from the States to go there at one time on a reduced rate kind of deal to produce a brochure and to introduce people who had not seen it to what Christmas Island had to offer. And the folks there were very receptive. They thought it was a good idea, and we put together, I can't remember exactly the specifics, April, but it was something like, I think it was $1,000 or a little less than $1,000 to go to Christmas Island for a week, and included your airfare.
That included airfare?
Yeah. And so Susie said, well, you can get 24 people to go with you. Go ahead. And there were some givens that needed to go. You know, people that were well-known in the fly fishing industry that wanted to go there, that Frontiers wanted to be there. Val Atkinson was our photographer. Lefty Cray came with us, the owners of, you know, Bruce Kirshner from Sage, and the general manager of Cortland, and Yvonne Chouinard, I haven't thought of this for years. It was a who's who of the fly fishing industry. Luckily, they allowed me to have a couple wild cards, so I got to invite some people that I wanted to invite.
Yeah.
One of whom was Robbie Stewart from the Lower Dean River Lodge.
Oh, really?
Which is how I ended up with my spots on a Dean.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What's the story behind the map? It's been five, and I was doing the math when you were talking. It is 5 years since I met you. And 5 years ago, you were telling a story about a map of Christmas Island or Kiribati.
Yep.
And I'd love to hear it here.
Moana Fuati Cafe. Moana was the head guide at Christmas Island. Probably the fishiest person that I've ever had the privilege of fishing with. Moana's ability to see fish is far beyond anybody that I've ever come in contact with anywhere in the Keys or anywhere. Plus, he could only see out of one eye, so how he did it, I don't know. Moana was a Gilbertese native. He was a merchant seaman who ended up on Christmas Island taking care of his brother's wife. And he did some commercial fishing there and ended up being a guide at the Captain Cook Hotel. And Moana caught his very first bonefish with a fly rod when we were fishing together. And it really kind of changed his life. All of a sudden, he was a fly fishing guide, and he was an exceptional one. Moana and I got to be very good friends. I was down there quite a few times. Moana actually came to the States to the Fly Tackle Dealer Show one year and spent some time with us in Colorado. And over the course of, oh, probably 4 or 5 years, with my having been down there at least a dozen times over that course of time, Moana and I really became close. And one year, for the last day of the trip there in the evening, the hotel puts on a luau.
That's right.
They roast a pig and have lobsters, and it's a big feed. And it's a big deal for the guides to be able to go, because they get to eat stuff that they never get any other time. Like, they can eat as much ice cream as they want.
And they still do this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they dance. And it's amazing.
Yep. And so I asked Moana, I said, Moana, you're going to come to the luau tonight? And he said, no. He says, I am making a map of Christmas Island, of the flats of Christmas Island for you. And I said, well, that's very nice, Moana. I figured something on a bar napkin. I had no idea. Next day, he comes to the airport. There's no mention of the map. Well, it's one of those things, you know. The next time we're there is probably 6 months later or something. And just in passing, I made a brief mention of the map. And, oh, he says, I'm working on it. And I said, okay, I'm not going to say this, you know. It's just one of those things that it was really a neat offer, and we'll just go from there. And it was 2 years later. We're getting ready for the luau again. And I said, Moana, are you going to come to the luau tonight? You know, you could be my guest at the luau. And he said, no, Bill. He says, tonight I will finish the map. And I said, well, you know, there's been no mention of this for 2 years. And he comes to the airport the next morning, and he has rolled up in a tube the official survey map done by the British government of Christmas Island. The Republic of Kiribati was a part of the British Commonwealth until 1979. And they had a survey map. It's an official looking thing with longitude, latitude, very precise drawing of Christmas Island and all the little islands in the lagoon and all. And it's the largest coral atoll in the world. The lagoon is huge. We walked across it one day. It took us all day. We figured it was 12 miles or 14 miles to wind our way across this. And Moana unrolls this thing, and he's drawn the map of the flats on this official survey map, and all the flats are shaded in light green in the blue of the water, and it's dead nuts on.
How did he do it, though?
Well, he said, he gave me the map. He said, Bill, he said, I'm so sorry it took long time. He said, I had to pace it off. So over 2 years, he kept track of everything somehow in his head, or I don't know whether he sketched it, but it's dead nuts on.
That is incredible.
And
what was Charles saying? What's the map that we have hanging above our bed?
Well, okay, so I got this map, and I brought it back, and I took it down to Denver to the Fly Tackle Dealer Show to show Susie Fitzgerald. I said, look at this thing that Moana made for me. And she said, oh, we got to get copies of that made. I said, okay, well, that sounds good. Let's make, a certain number of them and sell them. But the money goes to Moana's kids' college fund.
Cool.
And so that was the way it was done. And I think that Frontiers printed up 200 copies. They're about a third the size of the original. I mean, mine is... I'm guessing it's 4 feet wide and close to 2.5, 3 feet tall. Somehow, well, Charles inherited one.
From Andrew.
Yeah. And that's, we talked about it. Charles, when we were talking about Christmas Island, the first day we met, he said, oh, mate, he said, you should see this map I have of Christmas Island. And I said, Charles, take a look at it. If you, if you read the inscription in the bottom, it says, for my best friend, Bill Fitzsimmons. And it describes a day of fishing when Moana and a guy named Sam Weller and Jackson Strait, who has a fly shop in Colorado, still is there, at Mountain Angler in Breckenridge, and Moana, the four of us hiked across the lagoon. And we caught well over 200 bonefish over the course of the day. Moana calls that now, it's called Bill's Track. And he's in, that's inscribed on the map. And you start at the north end of Go Like Hell Flat. Go Like Hell Flat gets its name because the only way you can get to it by truck is to get the truck up to about 50 miles an hour to make it across this mud flat. If you try to go slowly, you get bogged down.
Yeah.
You have to hydroplane across it.
Right.
And you start there and you hike across the lagoon. A couple places you've got to put your rod in your teeth and hold your pack up in the air to get across something that's a little deep at certain tides, but it can be done.
Do they still do that trip? That's a big trip. That's a big day.
I don't think anybody does that anymore. I don't know that anybody else but Moana could find it. And I don't, you know, we were, I don't think the average guy going to Christmas Island is probably up for that.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. A few of them would be, yeah. But
it'll beat you up. I mean, granted, when I was there, I was just getting out of my first trimester, so I was really beat up being pregnant, obviously. But it beat me up pretty hard.
Yeah, it's the hot. Sun's pretty intense,
mm-hmm.
And it's.
It's a lot of walking. I don't know how those guys do it in the boots, if they're wearing boots. I mean, some of those guys do it without wearing anything on their feet.
Yeah, they were all barefoot when I first went there. We wore. Converse high tops.
Really? There were no flats boots then?
Oh, no.
So that was the go-to?
Yeah, Converse high tops with James Scott had those neoprene gravel guard things that you used to put over the old Red Ball waders so that they wouldn't get perforated inside your wading shoes.
Yeah. What about shirts? What did you wear for?
T-shirts.
T-shirts?
Yeah. The second or third year, they came out with tarpon wear. Which was horrible. Man, right. That stuff was hot. But that became sort of the uniform.
So Yvonne, if he was on that trip, he would have been thinking to himself, we've got to do better than this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that things had progressed a little bit by the time we did that. But I don't think that Patagonia did not have any, warm weather fishing stuff. In fact, I think that they were just starting to get into fly fishing. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure of that now.
Yeah, because it was still climbing for so long.
Yep.
How did British Columbia end up in your life?
We were one of the first Sage dealers, and Don Green, who was one of the owners of Sage.
Dean.
Used to go up to the Dean and was really close with the Stewart family. He used to go up with to the Lower Dean River Lodge with Robbie Stewart's dad and Dick Blewett.
They still do it every year. Well, when I was guiding there, they still had weeks every
Sage,
year.
Yeah, Sage had a week. And at that time, it was when I went, Les Eichhorn always was on that trip, and Bruce Kirshner, who, owned Sage at that time, and a couple of the Sage reps, they had six spots. And then they would invite a dealer. And I got to go. I was invited by the Colorado rep at that time. And Robbie Stewart and I hit it off well. And the next year, somebody backed out at the last moment or something. And I got to go 2 years in a row. This was in the old camp before it got washed away.
Mm-hmm.
The third year was the year that I put together the Christmas Island trip.
Okay.
And Robbie Stewart was one of my wild cards.
That's right.
And Robbie, we're getting on a plane in Hawaii, and he's looking around, and there's, all the who's who of the fly fishing industry here. And Robbie looked at me and he said, I can tell I really don't deserve to be here. But he said, by the same token, you don't deserve the three spots you just got on the Dean. So for the next 20-some-odd years or something, two of my best friends and I went up and spent a week on the Dean.
That is incredible.
With Robbie. Yeah, we've had some phenomenal fishing up there. So obviously I enjoyed steelhead fishing. That was before the spay days.
Yeah.
You know, once you've done that, it kind of gets in your blood. So I chased them in a few other places. Used to go to the North Umpqua every fall and do my preseason order with Umpqua Feather Merchants and spend a week in September fishing the North Umpqua. And I went and caught them in Russia and started 1 year. We did a trip up here to the Bulkley. I put together a group and we came up to a lodge up here. And that would have been, oh golly, probably in the early 90s or so. And just did that once. The steelhead thing does not really lend itself as well to putting together groups from a fly shop. First of all, the groups for steelhead camps tend to be smaller, so they don't have the room for commissions and complimentary trips for the group leader and things like that. We did, however, keep a steelhead catch in Wrangell, and we had a 57-foot steelhead catch that we'd pick people up in Ketchikan. And then spend 10 days to 2 weeks between Ketchikan and Petersburg fishing all the inside passage.
Oh, that's
for steelhead on it. We had phenomenal steelhead fishermen.
Whose was
fishing.
That? Who owned that? Was that an operation?
The guy who ran the boat was a guy by the name of Ken Wyrick. He was from Aspen originally, and that's where I knew him from. And Ken was, a licensed captain who decided that that's what he wanted to do, and he and his wife moved up to Alaska, and he did all kinds of sightseeing trips, whaling trips, salmon fishing trips, bottom fishing trips, whatever. He wasn't a fly fisherman to speak of. But in those days, that run was, it was pretty good steelhead fishing. In terms of numbers of fish, it's the best I've ever seen.
When did you start here? Because I see you here every year.
I started coming up here the first 3 years or 4 years that I came up here. My better half passed away, and all of a sudden it was just me and my dog. I decided I needed to go do some steelhead fishing in the fall. So I a friend of mine, Tony Hayes from Tongariro Lodge, Tony's been coming up here, and we had talked about going steelhead fishing. So I got a hold of Tony, and I said, well, I'll meet you up there. I'm going to get us a travel trailer. So I went and bought this old Airstream, not the one I have now.
Okay. You know we look for you every single time that we go by the trailer park, and the Airstream is always in the exact same corner.
Oh, yeah, way up at the end, because I can put a run in there for the dog.
Right.
Between there and a fence, and he can run around in there. So Tony and I met Tony in Smithers. He flew in, and I dragged the trailer up here, and we went down and stayed on the Kispiox and did that for a couple years. No, actually, let me go back. That's not right. We met here and stayed at Fort Telqua on the Bulkley, and it blew out. It was huge, and it was dirty, and it wasn't getting any better, and we didn't know what to do. And this was back in the days when we could fish on the weekends and everything. So we started driving around, went down to the Kispiox. I looked at it and I said, you know, Tony, I've caught fish in the Dean when it looked a lot worse than what the Kispiox looks like right now. Mm-hmm. At least we can go fishing. So we came up here and grabbed the trailer, went down and parked it at Riverview? River's Edge, Riverview.
On the Kispiox.
Yeah. Left the trailer there. And I fished out of there for, 3 or 4 years until I was accused of being an illegal guide.
Oh, they hit you with that?
Yeah. Well, I had, I came up for a month.
You still come up for a month.
I know. But, and I had a bunch of friends, guys that I fished with, most of whom were still gainfully employed. They can't come up for a month. they can get a week. So I go to the airport on Saturday and drop somebody off and pick somebody else up.
Ah.
And then one of them, Mike Steiger, gosh, a guy from that I met on the Drake. Mike's fishing with me down on the Skeena after I'd picked him up. And a couple of the Canadian, there's a group at the campground that were somewhat upset that we did pretty well and they didn't do very well. And so they're thinking, well, this guy's coming up here. He's got to be guiding. I mean, he gets a new guy every week. You know, it fit the profile. I'll admit that. That certainly wasn't what I was doing. And it never occurred to me that it appeared that that was what I was doing. But they tipped off the powers that be, and we're down on the Skeena, and an officer comes up and starts talking to Mike. And Mike says,
oh, this should be good.
Yeah. He says to Mike, who are you fishing with? He says, oh, that guy up there. This is my first day. I just came in to fish with him. Well, how do you know him? Ah, I met him on the internet. Okay. I never met him before in my life. And so there it was. And
what did they do?
Well, he came up and gave me a lecture, and I said, hey, look, first of all, I don't need to guide.
Was this recent? Because you're talking to Drake Forum Board. I mean, I guess it's been around a long time.
Yeah, it has. This was 6 years ago or so, or 5 years ago. But at any rate, I became persona non grata at the campground down there, so that's why I started coming up here. And now pretty much it's just my brother comes up with me now. It's although we have other friends that show up at a time. Matt, you met.
Yeah.
Also from the Drake. And
how does someone like you, who, no offense, but I don't see you as being particularly internet savvy, unless I'm wrong. How do you get
You're
on
not.
The, okay, how did you get on the internet, Drake, on the Drake forum board?
Well, that's the only computer stuff that I have anything to do with. I don't do any of the face.
You don't
plant.
Do the Facebook? The
no.
Face plant.
No.
So, but what's the deal? You just got on the internet one day and you were like, I'm going to just check these guys out.
I don't
out.
Even remember. I don't recall exactly. Oh, I liked the magazine, I think, probably. It was very, I found it very refreshing. It was so far ahead of the
usual
Guts
suspects.
And Glory kind of fishing magazines that were available. And I read every one of those just because that was all there was.
Can I pick your brain about some fishing stuff?
Sure.
Okay. You guys do something, you guys fish differently and you catch more fish than most people I speak with.
Occasionally.
It's been 5 years of occasionally now of you catching more fish. And you fish really small and really light, and you do it with confidence. And I just wanted to pick your brain about it a bit. I know that the traditional way of fishing catches fish, but I usually can't seem to do it with as much confidence as, say, a Black and Blue, or even a Lady Caroline makes you, you know, it's large compared to the flies that you're fishing. Can you just explain to people listening what size and kind of fly you're using?
You know, I've always maintained that, especially with steelhead, that they're not hard to catch. They're just hard to find.
Okay, so talk me through your process. What do you think you're doing differently to, say, a lot of the young guns out there today?
We're doing something differently.
Yeah, what? You know, talk to me about it.
We're throwing something that they haven't seen before.
Okay, so light, are you using tips?
No.
But you're not fishing dry flies. You're kind of subsurface.
Well, sometimes they skate. Sometimes they're on the surface. Sometimes they're just underneath the surface.
They're like an inch long.
Yeah. Yeah, if that.
Yeah, and they're sparse and they're natural colored.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And so are you casting, are you following the whole grease line book? Can you walk me through the method to your madness?
It's identify the water that you think that they're going to be in. You know, cover, depth and speed, and these fish are aggressive. They'll come to the top. Not all of them.
Yeah.
I think I could catch more fish on tips if I fished them.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
You just don't enjoy doing it?
No.
Are you?
I like the casting.
Yeah.
I like casting a dry line. I like throwing a single spay or a snake roll or something. Plus, I fish out of my boat. I never get out of the... I'm always standing in the middle of the Watermaster because I get a puppy on the front of it who, if I put him on the bank, he's going to be in...
Kispiox.
Yeah. He'll be in Terrace before I know it. So,
but are you trying to have your fly present itself? Like, what is the end goal for your fly? How do you want it looking to the fish?
I want it to move across in front of that fish as naturally as it can. No sudden movement, no, and kind of keep it in front of them, but not stopped. Just so it's a nice smooth swing. And I always tie a loop knot on the fly, so I think the fly's kind of fluttering a little bit, and it just looks like it's something alive. And let's face it, these fish made a living for quite a while eating little bugs. And even if they're not feeding now, you're just triggering a feeding response. And something clicks in their little tiny little brains and say, whoop, there's one of those. And here they come off the bottom in 4 feet of water and eat this tiny little thing that you'd think that they couldn't even see sometimes. But
they do.
They do.
So you're not just fishing slower water then. You're fishing everything and you're just...
Oh, I'm fishing everything. Exactly. I'll catch him in the faster water. If I find a fish and he shows himself and I don't stick him, I'll stay with him.
So what do you do?
Switch flies, change things a little bit. I've had a fish.
What would the first change be? Sorry, I'm just getting excited here.
Smaller and darker, usually.
Okay.
I had a fish. You remember that place up here where we met when you guys were having lunch? You know where Charles's Island is?
Yeah. Oh, upriver, you mean?
Yeah, upriver.
Yeah.
Where am I pointing in the wrong direction?
Yeah, that's right. Just up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just below that on River Right, there's a really good pockety kind of... Lots of big rocks and stuff. Okay, we call that the lunch spot now.
Okay.
I had a fish in there that came to five different flies over a little bit, about over 2 hour period before I finally got it.
So why do you think he finally took?
I don't know.
But you just refused to give up?
He never felt the hook. You know, I think once you sting them, they're done, or at least it always seems that way to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the first fly, I was fishing I fish a buck bug a lot.
Yeah.
It's about maybe an inch long or so, might be a hair over an inch, but about an inch long. And I put that down through, and I saw the fish boil behind it, you know, because the fly's not an inch beneath the surface in that fast water like that with a floating line and a long light leader that flies right on top. Sometimes it's waking.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see him. I saw him boil. And I dared again. He boiled on that fly again. Then he went away. Wouldn't come back. I never felt him. I use a Thunder and Lightning.
Okay.
It's an old Atlantic salmon kind of fly.
Yeah, I thought so.
That's my comeback fly. And so I put on a little Thunder and Lightning and put it down through there. And it beep, beep, just felt a little like a smolt kind of thing. And then nothing. So I stopped and brought it back in, make about three or four steps upstream, tied on a little skunk, a little green butt skunk, put it down through there. He boiled on that one. Wouldn't eat it. Let's see what I put on something else. I probably put on a smaller buck bug and tried that. Nothing. And I used this kind of a little caddis, a moose hair caddis thing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's just a nondescript brownish moose hair with a muddler kind of head and moose coming out all the way around the body. It just looks like a bug in the water. And it ate that, but never stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wouldn't come back. So I said, okay, that's it. I went back to the buck bug that I had on first, took about two steps upstream, made one step down, and there he was.
Do you adjust the speed of your swing to match the size of your fly?
Not really, no. Not intentionally.
But you know, it's interesting. I read Topher Brown's Atlantic Salmon Magic book, and he has this theory that a smaller bug or fish can't swim as fast through the current as a larger one. So if you're fishing a smaller fly, you should have a slower swing and vice versa.
I don't speed the fly up at all with steelhead. I always try to keep, you know, keep the swing just pretty constant. No herky jerky, you know, just, I mean, that's the way it probably, there's other people who do it that catch more fish than I do and have been doing it a lot longer that do it differently. But that is what I've always done. I try to make a cast so that as soon as the fly hits the water, it's fishing.
Okay, yeah.
So I probably cast more downstream than most people cast across, more than I do. I'll try to cast a longer line so I get a bigger piece of the pie, but I keep that angle the same. Mm-hmm. And just let it come across as slowly as I can with a line as straight as possible. I hate it when my line does this, does that snake thing in it. I want it just nice and straight.
Do you ever step downstream while you're swinging?
Nope. Never thought of it. Yeah. Might work sometimes. I don't know. If you step down when you're swinging, to me it's counterintuitive because what I like to go in there and think, okay, somewhere in this run is a fish. And I am going to make sure that I make my fly do what I want it to do in front of that fish.
Make sure he sees it.
Yeah. So if I blow a cast, I repeat it. Or if something happens where all of a sudden, if there happened to be a fish there, he wouldn't have seen that fly, I'll repeat the cast and make sure that he does. Mm-hmm. So if you step down some of the time, you're lowering the fly, maybe below a fish or something. I don't know.
It's hard to stay consistent.
Well, I try to, and sometimes it works, you know.
What about if it's bright outside versus if it's overcast?
I don't pay any attention to it.
Yeah, I don't either.
Maybe it would make sense with some of the winter fish. You know, I have done not a tremendous amount, but a fair amount of fishing for those winter fish with big gaudy flies, and it maybe a bright fly on a bright day. I don't know.
But don't you live in Washington now?
Yeah.
You didn't dive into the winter steelhead?
I do some. You know, I keep the trailer over in Forks during the winter. And my brother comes up for a while and spends a month there, and he really gets into it more so than I. I don't enjoy the winter flake fishing experience as much as I enjoy doing it up here, where it's summer weather and dry line and not raining.
Yeah.
And I feel like I can get away a little bit better up here. You know, it's Washington's getting, it gets pretty crowded down there.
Do you find it's gotten pretty crowded here too?
Yes, but it's, you know, we don't get out there at the crack of dawn.
Yeah.
The people that are aggressive and just have to be there and stuff like that, they're usually long gone by the time I get on the river. I get my 6 or 8 hours of fishing in, that's about all I need.
I like your style. Do you find that you catch smaller fish by fishing up top?
No.
And I ask only because when I was doing my television series, I was fishing a bamboo rod, light line, and, you know, traditional flies. And then I would always fish with somebody who was fishing a skagit line and a tip and a big marabou leech or something similar so that we could compare. And I was hooking a lot smaller fish and people going through behind me and dredging for catching larger fish.
Boy,
I caught some big fish, but not as many as the dredged fish.
It doesn't seem like that to me. I mean, these fish here, in a typical year, you always see some of the, we call them Maurice fish. I don't know if that's indeed what they are, but they're fish that appear to have spent less time in the salt. And they're
6 pounds.
Yeah, 25, 26, 27 inches, you know. Delightful little fish. You always see some of those. They are far from the majority.
Yeah, so you're still catching big fish up top,
yeah,
of that.
Yeah.
I often wonder if it's just that when I fish, when a lot of us are fishing lighter stuff, it's usually earlier in the summer or earlier in the fall. And that is when the smaller fish are in. Because I've always found that the bigger fish tend to come in a little bit later.
Well, that could be. That could be.
For tonight, is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me?
I guess it's sad to me to realize that we'll have conversations about how things used to be, and it's unfortunate that they'll never be that way again. But 10 years from now, some of these young kids out there will be talking about what we're seeing right now, and these will have become the good old days, you know?
Yeah.
You can remember 10 years ago when we used to be able to go out and hook a fish or two every day? I fear for these fish. Being a steelhead's a hard way to make a living anymore. And it just seems like the elements and the politics and the unfortunate greed that is a part of our society is going to conspire to make it tough for these things to live. You know, I mean, we drive along to Thompson on the way up here. It breaks my heart to do that. You think of what that used to be. Last year, they thought there might have been 120 of them that made it back. 120 fish.
It's the biggest environmental tragedy that I have personally experienced. I mean, there's a lot of tragedies happening.
Look at what's
right
happening.
Now,
yeah, look at this run this year. I mean, who knows? It's always been cyclical. Let's face it. And you see things like the Skagit, where the run is not what it used to be, but it's still fairly healthy. You know, they're getting their 8,000 fish or 10,000 fish or something like that. So maybe it's possible. But you know, I think with the climate change and the water quality issues and the fact that there's just too many bipods on this orb anymore, you know, we better enjoy and try to protect what little we do have left, and hope that our kids get to enjoy it. But I'm fearful that it's probably not going to happen. I find no comfort in saying that, certainly. You know, and maybe as you get older and things have changed, you take on a pessimistic view of things. But I can't think of a resource that is getting a whole lot better now as a result of what we're doing. We're loving these special places to death.
Would you stop?
Well, you know, I kind of feel like the way I go about it lessens my impact. I do think that I could catch more fish if I wanted to get down and dirty and stick something big in their face. I don't know that for a fact, but I believe that that's it. No, I sometimes feel guilty about still pestering them, but I don't feel like with the few fish that we catch and the way we handle them, and that we're doing much damage. But I still do at times feel guilty about it, no question. Not enough to stop, but a little guilty.
Well, I'll be having another podcast about that in a future episode, about if catch and release is selfish, and if it is, if it's okay to be selfish every once in a while.
That's an interesting thing. There is sort of a primal urge to go out and hunt and fish. I know I find that in myself. Maybe it's something that's born into us. It wasn't all that long ago that we had to do that to live, and it's something that is there. Here's a way to satisfy that.
But why not fish for salmon and take home salmon? Because I found myself fishing the other day, and I'll be honest, a steelhead would have been cool, but I was targeting coho. And Charles, he just couldn't understand where I was coming from. I feel like, I mean, I still love catching steelhead, but I don't know. I every season, I never know. I can never predict where my head's going to be at. Sometimes I just am steelhead crazed, and I need to catch steelhead, and then other times I just want to leave them alone. I can't figure myself out.
I guess that's the human nature in all of us. To me, it's I find it physically fun to go out there and go through the process. I notice things on the river that, were it not for those fish, I wouldn't be there to notice some of the other things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum, you know. I don't know that there is a singular answer to it. I guess we all have to come up with our own answer. And
I think we all have our own individual answer.
And be comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And it, if at some time it doesn't feel right to do it anymore, then I guess you move on to something else. I don't know.
Well, listen, I'm going to wrap it up.
Alrighty.
And let you get out. And I just thank you so much for meeting up with me tonight.
My pleasure, April. It's, as I say, you were scraping the bottom of the barrel here with your...
I've been trying to get to you for years. It's just, it's always, there's always just, it's just too hard.
We're busy fishing,
you know. In Steelhead Camp. But, I mean, even out there tonight, we're sitting by the fire, and it's like, okay, we got to get up and go inside and do this. It's hard to leave the fire.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just hard to verbalize some of these things, you know?
It's almost always hard to verbalize some of these things.
Yeah.
Well,
alrighty.
Thank you so much. And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.